Tom O'Brien brought a special video for us. You'll see it right now. And that is the prelude to what we're going to be learning about. I don't have my shoes on.
Thank you. Hello, everyone. I'm sure Dr. Tom O'Brien will fill us in to the connection with that video to our conference, but it won't be me explaining that because I was just told to come up here after it was over. So my name is Mia Schleifer. I live in Brooklyn, New York, and I discovered Dr. Rita Marie in the fall of 2013 and did her green cleanse. It really helped me with some chest pain that I was experiencing. I still don't know why I had it, but I said, wow, this woman knows something. And I joined the Shine Conference last January 2014 and was immediately enamored with her and her brilliance, and immediately, without hesitation, signed up for the NEPT course from 2014. So I'm in that first group. It's still ongoing this year, and this year is the 2015 group. So through her program, she's so generous, I was able to join the Grand and the Before Begun, and I was able to solve some other health issues where I was having irregular heartbeats. Again, didn't want to go to the cardiologist, and I actually never went because I don't have it anymore. So I'm just learning so much from her, and it just keeps continuing, and I'm so happy to see colleagues here from the NEPT 2014 course, like Lynn and Allison and Steph and some other familiar faces. And I'd just like to welcome back to the stage with a heartfelt welcome, Dr. Rita Marie Loscalzo.
And I'm not going to be up here all that long because I'm going to introduce one of my colleagues and dear friends who has made an impact on this world in a way that all of us have probably seen. Most of you have probably heard of Dr. Tom O'Brien. He started the Gluten Summit, and he's made it his mission to go around the world. He literally gets on planes and is traveling around the world teaching people and open their eyes about how gluten affects the gut, the brain, and just symptoms throughout the body. And he's done an amazing job of raising the awareness about gluten. So he's here today. He's also, he teaches all over the place. He teaches for the Institute of Functional Medicine. He's on their staff. And he's had private practice for a very long time and impacted many, many lives. And I am so proud and honored to introduce him to you today. So let's just stand up and give him a warm round of applause and welcome Dr. Tom O'Brien.
Hello, everyone. Thank you. It's really nice. Thanks. This is the first time I do about somewhere around 40 professional presentations a year, something like that. And I think this is the first time that I get to be ambidextrous. And that means that my clicker works for the computer back there, and my computer is not connected to the computer back there, so I've got to change my slides here so what you see there is the same. So I'm going to be... this will be fun. It's really an honor. It really is a pleasure to be here. Dr. Rita Marie does such great work in introducing these really difficult concepts in a way that is applicable, not just understandable, but applicable. How many feel they know about gluten? Show of hands, please. Yeah, I know about gluten. Show of hands. You know that's a loaded question, right? So you're doing this. Right. So if you can tell me why adults diagnosed with celiac disease, in the largest study ever done on mortality in celiac disease, published in the Journal of the American Medical Association in 2009, adults diagnosed with celiac disease have over a threefold increased risk of mortality in the first year after diagnosis. Why? You've heard me speak before. Really good. Yes. But you diagnose somebody with celiac disease, which is really important to do, and you increase their risk of mortality in the first year over threefold. I'll show you the studies. Most people don't know that, and they don't know why. or children diagnosed with celiac disease have a 40% increased risk of suicide, with or without a gluten-free diet? With or without? Say it again. With or without a gluten-free diet? With or without? So you'll know why. You'll know why in the next 90 minutes. And thank you so much, Dr. Rita Marie, wherever you are, for giving me 90 minutes. Thank you so much. Because I have 190 slides for you. And I don't have to talk as fast as my friend Jeff Bland. I can talk a little slower. So my first question, though, is how many of you were in attendance at last year's event? Can I see a show of hands? I talked about thyroid. Okay, great. Not the entire room, so I can use some of the same jokes. That'll be fine. I start with this one. Oh, I've got to change my slides here, too. That's right. I start with this one. This is in the Museum of Science in Florence. It's on display in the Museum of Science. This is Galileo's finger. Galileo's finger. Galileo bequeathed that all of his inventions could be on display for all of posterity as long as they also displayed his finger. It happens to be his middle finger. And it was Galileo's last message to the church. Because they suppressed him. They tried to squash him and squash what he knew was true. And his life was not a happy life. There's two books on Amazon. If you type in Galileo's finger, these two books come up. It's interesting reading of how much courage this guy had to continue to share what has changed our lives in so many ways now, hundreds of years later. Hundreds of years later. But we start with that because I've been where you are, sitting in the audience many, many times over the years, many times. And if it's a good speaker, the pens are flying, you know, smoke's coming from the notepad because check this on this patient, order this article, read this book, do this, pages and pages and pages of notes from a weekend seminar. And I'd go back to work on Monday morning and I didn't have time to implement any of it. Right? Have you had that experience? There's no time. So I came up with the acceptance for me that if there was one thing that I remembered for the rest of my professional career, that whole weekend, spending thousands of dollars, being out of my practice, away from my family, the whole weekend was worth it if there was one thing. So I hope what I tell you today is one thing that you take home with you this weekend. So what's coming your way in the next 90 minutes? I'm going to give you seven premises to consider, seven different premises, and three case reports. Conjunctival tumor, diagnosis Kaposi sarcoma, gluten psychosis in a 14-year-old, and amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. Very different conditions, but very similar. Right? Premise number one, food sensitivities may have a lasting, significant impact on central nervous system function. The foods you eat, if you're sensitive to those, they have a lasting impact after your headache is gone. Celiac disease is one of the most common lifelong disorders in both Europe and the U.S. Oh, by the way, my format is, this is the paper I read, this is the citation, this is the New England Journal of Medicine, and these are exact quotes from the researchers. Exact quotes. I haven't changed a word. If I've added anything, it's in parentheses. Okay? So they're exact quotes. Now, these guys and ladies are not English majors. They're geeks. So sometimes you have to read a sentence two or three times to understand what they're trying to tell you because you're not a geek. So you don't speak geek very easily, right? So you have to read it once or twice. It's like you see that, one of the most common lifelong disorders. Yeah, okay, okay. So if it's one of the most common lifelong disorders, how often is it in your practice? How often are you diagnosing it? Is there a disconnect? Just that one sentence from that paper can shift your whole practice. But you have to like kind of read these things a couple, I have to read them a few times to get the message of, they didn't write that in there just for the sake of it. I mean, they're trying to tell you, hey, this is so common. is one of the most common lifelong disorders you're going to see in your practice. 36% of patients with celiac referred for a neurological opinion have substantial structural and functional brain deficits and show significant brain abnormalities on an MR imaging. What would a structural deficit be on an MRI? Atrophy, your brain is shrinking. That's exactly right. Atrophy, the brain is shrinking. What? Yes, watch. So in this paper, I love the title, Should We Be Nervous About Celiac Disease? Brain Abnormalities in Patients with Celiac Referred for Neurological Opinion. So if they're referred for a neurological opinion, they're going to a neurologist. So their general practitioner recommended them, or their internist recommended them to a neurologist because they have neurological complaints. What did they find? The retrospective examination of a consecutive cohort of patients. Now, what does it mean to be consecutive? It means everyone that comes in, they don't screen, they're not cherry picking. Everyone that comes in, when they look at them, what did they see in 44 patients? Patients with celiac disease have three main types of neurological complaints: balance disturbances, headaches. How come people in their 70s can't do this? How come they have to go? And they can't do this? How come they can't do that? It's because their cerebellum has shrunk and they don't have control in their brain anymore. This is a segue. 26% of patients in my practice, 316 consecutive patients, who had elevated antibodies to gluten, 26% of them had elevated antibodies to their cerebellum, killing off their brain. What do you feel when you have elevated antibodies to your cerebellum? Nothing. You don't feel it. You can't tell that it's happening. What do you feel when you have elevated antibodies to myelin basic protein? Nothing. Until there's so much of the myelin destroyed, now you get the symptoms of MS. Do you think you get MS when you get the diagnosis? Years beforehand it starts. Years. That's what I'm talking to you about in this next 90 minutes. So balance disturbances, headaches, and sensory loss. 36% of patients, of those 44 patients, demonstrate white matter abnormalities, unexpected for the patient's age, with the highest incidence in those with headaches. White matter abnormalities are lesions in your brain, like scabs in your brain, dead scar tissue in your brain. 36% of the people referred to a neurologist with celiac had white matter lesions in their brain. That's more than one out of three. This subgroup averaged, and this is the headache subgroup, averaged almost twice the number of white matter abnormalities per MR imaging than the subgroup with balance or sensory loss. Headaches are the worst. This is what the white matter lesions look like. The arrows are pointing to them. This is what it looks like where it's shrinking, the areas that are shrinking. These two here, where number three is, these two are supposed to be the same size. These are supposed to be the same size, and a little larger, actually. But people don't feel that until they start getting symptoms and they get referred to a neurologist and they find by that point, more than a third of them have lesions in their brain. Patients with established celiac disease referred for neurological opinion have substantial structural and functional brain deficits and show significant brain abnormalities. MR imaging may provide valuable biomarkers of disease in this patient cohort. So what patients with celiac would you, and they have neurological complaints, would you recommend for an MRI? What percent? 100. Well, now, doc, it's not that bad. No, Mrs. Patient, we need to see if you've already started developing lesions in your brain, because if so, that's not good, but that's the biomarker. This is where we start. Then a year from now, we'll check again and see if we've been able to stop it. Irrespective of how you feel, we have to stop killing off your brain cells. Does that make sense to you? There was a tendency, at least in those patients presenting with cerebral manifestations, the balance disturbance and headaches, for an increase in the incidence of white matter lesions in patients who were non-compliant with the gluten-free diet. The incidence of white matter lesions in patients with celiac presenting with headaches and compliant with the gluten-free diet, 50% of them. They're strictly compliant, 50% of them have lesions in the brain. The incidence of white matter abnormalities in patients with celiac presenting with headaches and non-compliant, every one of them, 100%. Every one of them has lesions in their brain. Oh, I don't feel bad when I eat gluten. Yeah, I can have a little once in a while. Results from this study show that patients with celiac and neurological complaints have significant cerebral and cerebellar abnormalities in comparison with age and sex matched healthy volunteers. I just realized that I'm such a habit of choice, I haven't changed one slide here. So I'm turning this way, and I really don't want to turn this way. I want to be looking at you, but you know, we'll just make it work one way or another. Boom, 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 boom. Especially when compared with the control cohort, this group of patients with celiac and neurological complaints has significantly smaller cerebellar volume. What does that mean if you have smaller cerebellar volume? Hi. That's smaller cerebellar volume. You don't notice it. Our finding of cerebellar atrophy in the patient group concurs with previous autopsy reports that have shown selective loss of Purkinje cells. That's a type of neuron in the cerebellar cortex of patients with celiac and neurological complaints. It also shows functional and clinical correlation in the vast majority of patients complaining of balance disturbances. The mechanisms underlying Purkinje cell loss in relation to gluten sensitivity are yet to be fully elucidated. However, current theory tends towards an immune-mediated cellular destruction. That means we don't have a slam dunk as to why this is happening, but it really looks like it's inflammation. That's what they're trying to say in geek language. We published this paper back in 2004, Dr. Vojdani and I. We conclude that a subgroup of patients with autism produce antibodies against Purkinje cells and gliadin peptides. Gliadin is a peptide of wheat when wheat's not digested well, which may be responsible for some of the neurological symptoms in autism. We found that children with autism had significantly higher levels of both gluten and cerebellar peptide antibodies in more than 80% of the cases. If gluten peptides were elevated, cerebellar peptide antibodies were also high. We looked at that because in my practice before that, I said, Dr. Vojdani, 26% of everybody that has gluten antibodies elevated have antibodies to their brain, to the cerebellum, 26% of them. He said, no, Tom, it can't be that high. Let's check. So we did this study, and we found 80% of autistic kids that have elevated antibodies to gluten also have elevated antibodies to their cerebellum. There's a fire in the brain in these kids. And this is the bar graph that we put in our paper. The one on the left is IgG antibodies, IgM antibodies, and IgA. Antibodies to gliadin, the peptide of wheat, is in white, and antibodies to cerebellum is in black. That's how they correlate. And that's 40% of the kids with autism. So what our study showed was that if they have elevated antibodies to gluten, 80% of them have elevated antibodies to their cerebellum. This is like, wow, right? You know, if you have a heart attack and you survive, you say, well, you know, if I change my diet and exercise a little bit, I'll be fine. Or if you have cancer and you go through treatment and it's in remission, you know, well, you know, God help us, I'll be around for a while. But what if you're diagnosed with a brain deterioration disease? Doesn't that just freak us out? You think there's nothing you can do? Yes, there is. Dale Bredesen runs the Alzheimer's Research Center at UCLA, published a paper last September showing that he reversed Alzheimer's in 9 out of 10 card-carrying Alzheimer's patients within 5 years. 9 out of 10 of them by following a functional medicine protocol. 44 things on his checklist. His paper is free online. Just Google Dale Bredesen, B-R-E-D-E-S-E-N. B-R-E-D-E-S-E-N. By the way, I'm going to give you guys links for all 27 papers that I'm showing you. Yeah, 15 of them are the full paper. They're free. So you'll have the links for all of that. Abnormalities in these regions have been shown to be associated. Oh, no, I'm changing my slide, but not yours. Let's back up. Other areas of the brain, including the gyrus rectus and anterior cingulate gyrus, also showed significant gray matter loss in the subject group. Why is that important? That's important because those are the areas associated with executive and psychomotor function. And gray matter loss in these areas was found in patients with depression. Abnormalities in these regions means they're shrinking. So executive function, what does that mean? You can't process information very well. You don't think through, this is coming in and this is coming in. Okay, what should I do? Okay, good, I'll do this. You just don't process very well anymore. That's executive function. The extent and pattern of gray matter loss in patients with celiac receiving a gluten-free diet compared with controls raises important questions about possible subclinical neurological disease in these patients and the need for early diagnosis and treatment with a strict gluten-free diet. That's geek language. You understand what he's saying? In geek, check it out early, completely gluten-free. Because you don't feel when you have elevated cerebellar antibodies. In this paper in the journal Pediatrics, they looked at 75 kids diagnosed with celiac disease. They did MRIs on them, and what did they find? Well, they found neurological disorders were in 51% of these kids. For every one person that gets abdominal complaints, there are eight that don't. So if you look for abdominal complaints in order to think about whether there's a problem with the food you're eating, you'll get it right when they come in with abdominal complaints, and you'll miss it 7 out of 8 times because their complaint is in their brain. They've got seizures, or they've got attention deficit, or they've got depression, or the complaints are in their liver, and they've got PMS because they're not breaking down estrogen very well after they ovulate. So the estrogen level goes up, and that's water retentive, and you get headaches, or you get PMS. And you're treating hormones when it's really a liver problem for that person. It just depends on where it's going to manifest. You pull at a chain, the chain always breaks at the weakest link. It's at one end, the middle, the other end, your heart, your brain, your liver, your kidneys, wherever your genetic weak link is, that's where you're going to get the symptoms when you have too much inflammation. Does that make sense to you? Yeah. I'll take questions at the end. I'm going to leave time for questions. So write your questions down, and then I'll take them at the end. And here's the symptoms that the 51% of kids had that had celiac disease: developmental delay, seizures, learning deficits, and attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, headaches, ataxia, tics. Of 75 biopsy-proven, mainly pediatric celiac patients, 20% of them had lesions in their brain. Now, this is not people referred to a neurologist. These are just people diagnosed with celiac. So 20% of the kids with celiac already have lesions in their brain. And that's what they look like. Case study number one, a conjunctival tumor diagnoses Kaposi sarcoma. You guys know what Kaposi sarcoma is? That's HIV. That's the cancer from HIV. Here's a 3-year-old girl. She presented with a lesion in her right eye. The medical history revealed premature cessation of breastfeeding, intolerance to the ingestion of baby foods, anorexia, abdominal distension. First thing you think of with that, what's going on in the gut? What's going on in the gut? Her weight and height were below normal. From 26 months of age, recurrent serous otitis media treated with systemic antibiotics. Initial visit showed the visual acuity was 20/20, but there was a spider-like lesion above the pupil of the eye. That's the pupil down there. So the person's looking down and they lift the eyelid up to see above the pupil. That's a tumor in the eye in a 3.5-year-old girl. The presumed diagnosis was conjunctival, the conjunctiva is the eye, surface of the eye, Kaposi sarcoma. Why? Because mom was HIV positive. So the ophthalmologist immediately assumed it's an HIV Kaposi sarcoma tumor. No, her blood test was negative. The little girl's blood test was negative. She did not have HIV. So they wanted to do biopsy on this little girl's eye. But they'd done a blood test earlier, another doctor, a couple weeks earlier, and high levels of gliadin and endomysium antibodies, those are the blood tests, some of the blood tests for celiac, and they did a biopsy and they found out she had celiac disease. They gave the child a general anesthetic for the endoscopy, and the child had a reaction to the general anesthetic. And for a couple of weeks, child wasn't in great shape, and so the parents said, no, we don't want to do a biopsy right now. We're going to wait a little bit until our child calms down because she's terrified right now of doctors. We don't want to traumatize her anymore by putting her under a general again and have her get sick again. But they did put her on a gluten-free diet. After diagnosed celiac, they put her on a gluten-free diet. The lesion gradually regressed and was gone in 2 months. You reverse tumors in the eye on a gluten-free diet. Sometimes. Kind of rare, but. So a patient comes into you and says, my daughter's just been diagnosed with a tumor in her eye. They want to do a biopsy. Oh, I'm so sorry. Please follow your doctor's advice. But let's check her. Check her for what? Check her for a food sensitivity, because I was in a seminar and I saw these studies that sometimes a food sensitivity can cause the tumor in the eye, and you put them on a gluten-free diet and the tumor goes away. It's very rational to check. It's irrational to put everybody on a gluten-free diet. That's irrational. But I'm always looked upon, you know, Dr. Bryan, he's the expert. He thinks everybody should be gluten-free. No, he doesn't. He thinks everyone with a health concern should be tested properly to see if there is a benefit in going gluten-free, right? She was completely asymptomatic, and the conjunctival lesion did not recur after 9 months of follow-up. Premise number two, gluten sensitivity is not yet recognized by practitioners as a primary presentation in their offices. How many of you know or suspect that you may have a sensitivity to gluten? Show of hands, please. Hold them high for a minute, if you would, please. I guess the front row is not that many people. Okay. Look around the room. Hold your hands high. Okay, thank you. Put your hands down. Thank you. There's an emerging problem encountered. By the way, this is not a lecture to celiacs, is it? It's a lecture to healthcare practitioners, right? 90% of the room just raised their hand. Do you think your practice is different? Well, no, these are healthcare, but they're just more healthy conscious. And well, yeah, they're more healthy and conscious. There's an emerging problem encountered in clinical practice of patients complaining of gluten-related symptoms despite the absence of diagnostic markers for celiac, such as negative celiac serology and normal duodenal biopsies. These patients pose a clinical dilemma to healthcare professionals, and in the past have been described as belonging to a no man's land due to the diagnostic uncertainty. For those that can't see it, it says, please tell me more. Please tell me more about this imaginary fence. And they've got an electronic collar around their, or electronic fence thing on their neck. Okay, second question. How many know or suspect that if you have an inadvertent exposure to gluten, it seems to affect your brain? Show of hands, please. Again, high for a minute. Look around the room. High, so that everybody can see it. Thank you. Put your hands down. Thanks. So the question is, do you think the percentages in this room are different than the percentages in your practice? No. So how often should you be thinking about maybe there's a sensitivity to gluten? How often? All the time. If 9 out of 10 or 8 out of 10 know that, yeah, I don't, you know, it seems to affect my brain, yeah. You might just want to consider, irrespective of what they're presenting with, and we'll go through more of that. So at a referral center for neurology, this is not gastroenterology now, this is neurology, this is Columbia. When the cause of a neurological disease is known, the percentage of those patients with elevated antibodies to gluten is 5%. When the cause of a neurological disease is unknown, they can't put a diagnosis on it, the percentage of those patients with elevated antibodies to gluten is 57%. Like this room, so many people just raise their hand, it seems to affect their brain. That's what they find at Columbia. When the primary practitioner couldn't take care of it, and they referred it to a neurologist, and the neurologist couldn't take care of it, so they referred to the research center, the tertiary research center. That's Columbia. And when they can identify, oh, you've got polyclonal myositis, only 5% of those people have elevated antibodies to gluten. But when they think, well, I don't know what's wrong, we can't, you know, there's nothing that shows up, let's check them for gluten. Oh, look, there it is again. That's really how they're looking at this now. They just can't believe how often elevated antibisagglutin is a component of the profile of people that they can't put a diagnosis to by traditional diagnostic approaches. So the third question here in this one, how many of you with a suspected sensitivity will have a little gluten once in a while? Come on, come on. Put your hands up high, high for a minute, please. Look around the room, look around the room. Yeah. So about 80% of the 80% just raised their hand. So the question then is, it would seem that the disconnect is not only on the awareness of the frequency, but also the acceptance of the relevancy. You don't accept that it's relevant. You think it's okay to have a little once in a while. You can't be a little pregnant. Sorry, you can't. And that's what we're going to talk about now. Gluten, not pregnancy. Although that's what got me into all of this, you know. I was an intern and my ex and I couldn't get pregnant. I called the seven most famous doctors I'd ever heard of and I said, what do you do for infertility? They all told me what they did. I put a program together. We were pregnant in 6 weeks. 6 weeks. Our neighbors in married housing heard about this. We lived on campus. They said, well, you work with us? And I said, well, I don't really think it's going to hurt you. Yeah, sure, I guess. She'd been through artificial insemination. Nothing had worked. She was pregnant in 3 months. I was hot to trot. I was ready to go out and help everyone get pregnant. But more often than not, it's the guy and not the woman. It's a problem. When a couple mates and the man ejaculates, millions of sperm are swimming up the canal. How come only one or two penetrate an egg? The sperm hits the egg. The head of the sperm secretes an enzyme that digests a little bit of the mucus. And then the sperm can swim right in. It activates a gene that shuts down the mucus layer. No other digestion can occur from other sperm that hit the egg, right? That's why only one or two get through. It's a beautiful system. That enzyme in the head of the sperm that digests a little bit of mucus so it can swim in is completely zinc dependent. So if you have a zinc insufficiency, not even a deficiency, if you have a zinc insufficiency, the guy's firing duds. And every test in fertility clinics, they do a bunch of tests for women, usually, and guys, sperm count, sperm motility, that's all they check. Last 20 years, that's all they check. So the guy's all nervous, you know, the test results come back. Doc says, oh, you're normal. The guy says, oh. Must be you, honey. And then the woman gets shot full of hormones, and there's no hormone deficiency, but they shotgun into the woman, right? What a masochistic system that is. So I check every infertile couple, you know, zinc tally, you know, the little liquid zinc product. Yeah, everyone gets tested for that. And I won't see a infertile case if the husband doesn't come in. And we had a couple of them that were really upset. I'm sorry, doctor won't see you unless your husband comes. But he's the president of blah, blah, blah bank. He said, oh, that's congratulations, it's very nice. Doctor won't see you unless your husband comes in. So the guy comes in, he's cocky as can be, he's arrogant, you know, he's big shot kind of guy. You know, and he's on his phone when I walk in and he doesn't get off the phone when I walk in. And if that happens, it's happened a few times, I just turn around and walk out and I let them wait a half hour. Right? It's my territory, right? But then when I test him for zinc and the guy's got a zinc, and the way it goes with the zinc tally, for those of you who don't know, you just pour a little in the cap and for sanitary reasons, you pour that into a little cup and you say, please drink this. And they drink it and you just watch them and they go, and they're looking at you, okay, doc. And I said, well, Mr. Patient, does it kind of taste like water? Well, yes. I said, well, if you have enough zinc, that's the most god-awful thing you've ever tasted. And the diagnosis is how cringing a face the person makes. I'm not exaggerating. It's like, ooh, ooh, ooh. That's normal. You think it tastes like water. You've got a zinc deficiency. You're likely firing duds. They get it. They get it right away. And I've had three couples that I know of, they were pregnant a few weeks when the guy started taking zinc. Right? Okay, back to a little bit of gluten once in a while and the fertility thing. So here's a study. They looked at 1,000 celiacs and 3,300 of their first degree relatives. Now the standard mortality ratio in celiac is 2 to 1. What does that mean? I'm 63. If I had celiac disease, I don't, but if I did, and my brother is 62 and he did not have celiac disease, I'm twice as likely to die at 63 of something than when my brother gets to be 63. I'm twice as likely to die at 35 than when my brother gets to be 35. I'm twice as likely to die at 90 than when my brother gets to be 90. That's the SMR. That's what SMR means. Standard mortality ratio, right? It's 2 to 1 in celiacs, with or without a gluten-free diet. So you put someone on a gluten-free diet, they still have a 2 to 1 SMR. You think it's complete to put them on a gluten-free diet? No, that's the prerequisite. That's not the treatment, that's the prerequisite to the treatment. So they followed them for 20 years. And they looked to see every year, can we have copies of your records from visiting your doctor, copies of any blood tests? Please fill out this questionnaire. How have you been on following the diet? Have you been stringent, really, really focused, or have you been cheating once in a while? When you cheat, how do you cheat? Is it pasta? Is it bread? What do you, cookies? What is it? So they accumulated all this data, and they followed them for 20 years. What did they find? Those that were likely to follow the gluten-free diet, working really hard at it, really meticulous at it, their SMR was 0.5, half as often as opposed to twice as often, because they're working really hard at it. Those that were not likely to follow the gluten-free diet. Well, this is what the researcher said. This is geek language. Death was most significantly affected by diagnostic delay, pattern of presentation, adherence to gluten-free diet. Non-adherence to gluten-free diet, defined as eating gluten once a month, increased the relative risk of death sixfold. For all of you that cheat, you don't understand the relevance of a sensitivity to gluten. You think it's okay because you don't feel bad. You can't feel when cerebellar antibodies are elevated, or myelin antibodies are elevated, or cardiac antibodies are elevated, or gut antibodies are elevated. You can't feel it. So you think it's okay. So you keep doing a little gluten once in a while, even if it's once a month, you're 6 times more likely to die early. I call this the what talk. What? My daughter said, Dad, you are not cool, man. Just give it up, all right? Just give it up. Okay, honey. Okay. Wrong button. There we go. Nearly 50% of the patients were diagnosed with mild or symptomless celiac disease. There was a significant excess of deaths among patients who presented with only malabsorption symptoms. What are malabsorption symptoms? Anemia, osteoporosis. Can you feel when you have osteoporosis? No. Mild or symptomless celiac disease. Can you feel when you've got elevated antibodies to your cerebellum? No. That's mild or symptomless celiac disease. And it's a significant excess of deaths. Why? Because you don't feel bad. So you can't tell that all the inflammation that's in there is just chewing you up, wherever the weak link in your chain is. You can't tell. Make sense? Nod your head yes or shake your head no. Yeah, good. Premise number 3, gluten sensitivity with or without the enteropathy, celiac disease is a systemic autoimmune disease. Here's an article, gluten sensitivity from gut to brain. Gluten sensitivity is a systemic autoimmune disease. They're not saying celiac, they're saying gluten sensitivity is a systemic autoimmune disease with diverse manifestations. It's characterized by abnormal immune response to I think it's normal immune response, we'll talk about why later. I don't think it's abnormal, to ingested gluten in genetically susceptible individuals. Celiac disease or gluten-sensitive enteropathy is only one aspect of a range of possible manifestations of gluten sensitivity. You have to get away from thinking about celiac as being the big problem. It is not. It's one manifestation of a gluten-related disorder. Gluten-free diet results in a complete resolution of the headaches, but the white matter changes do not reverse. In this one, they do not reverse. The distribution of white matter abnormalities is more suggestive of a vascular rather than a demyelinating etiology. So what are they talking about here? Well, IgA, GLIDE, and antibodies from patients with celiac have been recently shown to cross-react strongly with blood vessel structures in the brain. What that means is if you have elevated antibodies to gluten, those antibodies strongly react with the brain blood vessels. They attack the brain blood vessels. And then you get antibodies to your brain. That's the Purkinje cells. The antibodies to gluten, your body gets confused and starts to attack other tissue. That's what cross-reactivity means. It attacks other tissue. Last year we talked about the thyroid and how it may attack the thyroid if that's the weak link in your chain. This year we're talking about the brain. And I've shown you that one already. Here's 224 patients with various causes of ataxia. Ataxia is when you can't walk very well. And it comes not from muscle problems, it comes from brain deterioration. The brain's not sending the message to the muscles to work properly. The prevalence of elevated antibodies to gliadin, a peptide of gluten, is 14% in familial atrophy ataxia, 41% in sporadic idiopathic ataxia, 15% in multiple system atrophy ataxia. I just show that to you, and it's really technical stuff, but meaning many different types of brain deterioration, a percentage of those people have elevated antibodies to gluten. Not all of them, but a percentage of them. So when you have a brain deterioration disease, doc, my husband's just been diagnosed with a brain, oh, I'm so sorry to hear that. Please follow your neurologist's advice, but let's check him. Check him for what? Well, let's check him for a sensitivity to foods, because sometimes foods may be the trigger causing the deterioration that's manifesting in the brain. And you don't want to keep throwing gasoline on the fire. Right? So, here's a 14-year-old girl misdiagnosed with psychosis. In recent studies, non-celiac gluten sensitivity has been related to the appearance of neuropsychiatric disorders such as autism, schizophrenia, and depression. A 14-year-old girl came to our outpatient clinic for psychotic symptoms that were apparently associated with gluten consumption. Watch this history. In May of 2012, after a fever, she became increasingly irritable, reported daily headaches and concentration difficulties. 1 month after, her symptoms got worse, presenting with severe headaches, sleep problems, behavior alterations, and several unmotivated crying spells and apathy. Her school performance deteriorated, as reported by her teachers. The mother noted severe halitosis, never suffered before. What's wrong with the gut? The patient was referred to a local neuropsychiatric outpatient clinic where a conversion somatic disorder was diagnosed. Ooh, big Scrabble words. And a benzodiazepine treatment was started. In June, during the final school exam, psychiatric symptoms occurring sporadically in the previous 2 months, they got worse. She began to have complex hallucinations. The types of these hallucinations varied and were reported as indistinguishable from reality. She saw people coming off the television to follow and scare her while she's taking final exams. So they thought she's just a nutcase trying to get out of taking her exams, right? She also presented with weight loss. She'd lost 5% of her weight. Gastrointestinal symptoms such as abdominal distension, severe constipation. She was admitted to a psychiatric ward at 14 years old. A CT scan of the brain and blood pressure holter performed results normal. EEG showed mild, non-specific abnormalities and slow wave activity. That's a clue for gluten sensitivity, is slow wave activity. All of you that said it seems to affect your brain, it slows down your brainwave patterns, and so you kind of notice you're like in brain fog or something. Due to the abnormal autoimmune parameters and the recurrence of psychotic symptoms, autoimmune encephalitis was suspected. They put her on steroids. In September, shortly after eating pasta, she presented crying spells, relevant confusion, ataxia. She couldn't walk, 14 years old, severe anxiety, paranoid delirium. Then she was again referred to the psychiatric unit. A relapse of autoimmune encephalitis was suspected, and treatment with IVs of steroids and immunoglobulins was started. During the following months, several hospitalizations were done for recurrence of psychotic symptoms. What's going on in this family with all of this, right? You're just trying your daughter, you want to save your daughter, and she's going down and down. They're admitting her into the psychiatric ward. They've got her on steroids. Cerebral and spinal cord magnetic resonance imaging, lumbar puncture, and eye exams did not show any pathological signs. Several EEGs were performed confirming bilateral slow activity. The laboratory tests showed only mild microscopic anemia, reduced levels of ferritin and a slight increase in fecal calprotectin. All markers for celiac were negative. She didn't have celiac disease. In September 2013, she presented with severe abdominal pain associated with asthenia, slowed speech, depression, distorted and paranoid thinking, suicidal ideation up to a state of pre-coma. The clinical suspicion was moving towards a fluctuating psychotic disorder. Treatment with a second-generation antipsychotic was started, but psychotic symptoms persisted. In November, due to GI complaints and further weight loss, she was sent to a nutritionist, and a gluten-free diet was recommended for symptomatic relief of her bloating. Unexpectedly, within a week, the symptoms, both gastrointestinal and psychiatric, dramatically improved, and the gluten-free diet was continued for 4 months. Until a few years ago, the spectrum of gluten-related disorders included only celiac and wheat allergy. Therefore, our patient would be turned back home as a psychotic patient and receive lifelong treatment with antipsychotic drugs. What kind of a life was in store for that girl? Right? Recent data, however, suggests the existence of another form of gluten intolerance known as non-celiac gluten sensitivity. Due to parental choice, the girl did not continue assuming gluten, and she started a gluten-free diet with a complete regression of all symptoms within a week. Within a week, her mother finally recalled that she was returned a normal girl. 9 months after definitely starting the gluten-free diet, she is symptom-free. It's been hypothesized that some neuropsychiatric symptoms related to gluten may be the consequence of the excessive absorption of peptides with opioid activity that form from incomplete breakdown of gluten. Increased intestinal permeability, also referred to as leaky gut, may allow these peptides to cross the intestinal membrane, enter the bloodstream, cross the blood-brain barrier, affecting the endogenous opiate system and neurotransmission within the nervous system. That all makes sense, doesn't it? You get a leaky gut, you get a leaky brain. Very often, because transglutaminase, which is the enzyme in the gut that's diagnostic for celiac, is a major component of the blood-brain barrier. You get elevated antibodies of transglutaminase. They don't just don't go after the transglutaminase in the microvilli of the intestines. They go after transglutaminase anywhere in your body, including your blood-brain barrier. And of course, they're in the blood. That's how you got found out, because you did a blood draw from the arm. So the blood circulates everywhere. It goes past the brain. They'll attack the brain. You get blood-brain barrier permeability. Premise number 4, food selection has a direct impact on dysbiosis and may be an initiating factor in an autoimmune cascade. Diet has a dominating role, these are geeks, dominating role in shaping gut microbiota, and changes of some key populations may transform the gut microbiota into a pathogen-like entity, despite a complete host genome. You can have all of the microbiota that you're supposed to have there, but you change your diet and the bad guys rear their ugly heads up and the good guys get suppressed. Diet changes explain 57% of the total structural variation in gut microbiota. Genetics only account for 12%. Foods rich in proteotoxins, such as gluten, casein, corn, and proteins, have been observed to have endotoxin-like effects that can contribute to dysbiosis. 75% of the food in the Western diet is of limited or no benefit to the microbiota in the lower gut. Most of it, comprised specifically of refined carbohydrates, it's just paste, is already absorbed in the upper part of the GI tract, and what eventually reaches the large intestine is of limited value, as it contains only small amounts of the minerals, vitamins, and other nutrients necessary for maintenance of the microbiota. Thank God for Dr. Rita Marie and how she feeds us, huh? Isn't that great? Yeah, yeah, it's really great. And it's not easy. It's not easy to work with the hotel on this kind of stuff. You want what? You want what? String mushrooms? You want what? What? It's not easy. The consequence is that the microbiota of modern humans is greatly reduced, both in terms of numbers and diversity when compared to the diets of our Paleolithic forebears and the individuals living a rural lifestyle today. Some of you have heard of this study that came out 5 years ago where they compared the microbiota of European kids and African kids. The African kids still living in villages, thatched villages, and very poor, like their ancestors thousands of years ago. Here is the microbiota. The top one is the African kids. The bottom one is the European kids. Now, the family of bacteria called Firmicutes is one that you don't want too much of. A little bit's okay, but it is the family that causes obesity. Have you heard that certain microbiota will cause obesity? It's the Firmicutes family, when you have too much. Well, look at the average in the African kids is 12% of the microbiota is of the Firmicutes family. But in the European kids, it's 42%. It's more than triple. Right? You count calories, you be selective in your food, you can't lose weight. It's the microbiota. You have to change the microbiota. And then you get great results. Attempts to reconstitute a normal microbiome by supply of probiotics have often failed, as they are almost always undertaken as a complement to, and not as an alternative to, existing treatment schemes, especially those based on antibiotics, but also other pharmaceuticals. We've been shotgunning probiotics in for 30 years, right? And they help. They help, but it's a new era in the world of probiotics. Ah, good. So point to two people close by. Close by you. Point to two people. Good, good. Okay, we're going to take a couple of minutes. What recommendations do you currently give in your practice to enhance the microbiome? All right, so take 2 minutes and just talk amongst yourselves of what you currently do to build the microbiome. Go. Okay, come back, please. Okay. We're about to have the drawing for the Cadillac. Premise number five. Both Parkinson's and Alzheimer's involve the formation of transmissible, self-propagating, prion-like proteins. This is a quote from a study I'm about to show you. So I read that sentence, and what did I say? I said, transmissible from where? Where is it transmitting from? Is it aliens? Right. Where is it transmitting from? I mean, that word just didn't make any sense. In the Journal of Alzheimer's Disease, 2015, this just came out. Transmissible. Transmissible from where? Where's that coming from? When a paper really catches me, I throw it up on the ceiling. I tape it to the ceiling in my bedroom. I do. I go to sleep at night and I go, oh, yeah. And then I just go to sleep. And sometimes some ideas come up. And I've got a little thing next to my bed, you know, in the middle of the night, I wake up and I write it down because I used to say, oh, I'll remember. I'd never remember in the morning. I'd never remember. So I have a little paper thing. You know, you pull the pen out and it's a very soft light so I can just see the paper, but it's not so bright that your eyes are squinting. It's really soft. It works. So I wrote one night, I got a transmissible from where? That's what I wrote. There's now robust evidence that gut bacteria influence the enteric nervous system, an effect that may contribute to afferent signaling to the brain. So, meaning afferent means the message is going from the gut up to the brain. And for every nerve that goes from the brain to the gut, there are 9 nerves that go from the gut to the brain. The ratio is 9 to 1. I wasn't taught that in school. I just learned that last year. Why would nature do that? Why would the Creator do that? Why would you have 9 times more highway going from the gut up to the brain than you have from the brain to the gut? If you think about that, if you start kind of pondering this stuff, you realize there's got to be a reason. So what is it? Well, there's more messages from here going up there than there is from there going down here. Right? That's why there's more messages. Watch. The vagus nerve has emerged as an important means of communicating signals from gut bacteria to the central nervous system. There, let me back that up. Messages from the gut bacteria. You all know that there's 10 times more cells of bacteria than there are the rest of the human body. 10 times more cells of bacteria in your gut than all your muscle, bone, skin, organs, cells, add it all up. 10 times more cells of bacteria. And those cells of bacteria have 150 to 200 times, depending on what paper you read now, 150 to 200 times more genes than the human genome. We have 23,000 genes. That's it, same as an earthworm. It's true. That's the human genome, 23,000 genes. Well, there's 150 to 200 times more genes in the bacteria in our gut than in the human genome. Now, genes control function. Genes determine proteins to be produced. Genes turn signals on and turn signals off. So tonight, after the second glass of wine, I want you guys to be asking, are we really humans with that much bacteria? Or are we bacteria having a human experience? When you think about it, if you really think about it, you know, it's kind of cute, you know, but I want to implant here. You know, you do this. Oh, what does that mean? Because when you start thinking, you know, one of my mentors, my first mentor in healthcare was Dr. George Goodhart. Dr. Goodhart was the founder of applied kinesiology. That's the muscle testing some of you may have seen in the past, right? He's the founder. We call him the Great Wazoo. And George, because he'd just come up with this stuff. It was, what? And he was right. But he'd always be on stage and he'd go, why, doctor? And he'd slam his foot like that for emphasis. Why does the body have 9 times more communication going up than coming down? Why? And he'd say, think, think. Well, what's the answer, Dr. Goodhart? I'm not going to tell you, think. Dr. Goodhart, his father was a naturopath in Detroit, second floor above a pharmacy, no elevator. And when he would work in the clinic as a teenager, he'd say to his dad, Dad, how come these old women with congestive heart failure, they can't walk up the stairs, but they can walk up the stairs just fine backwards? And they do. You can walk up the stairs backwards just fine with congestive heart failure. You can't walk up the stairs forward very easily. You walk backwards and you just kind of walk up slow and easy because you're awkward, you know, but you can walk up. And his dad would say, I don't know, you'll figure it out. And he did. He did figure it out. It's because there's a torque in your spine. And when you walk backwards, you detorque. So you take the pressure off the spine. You take the pressure off the lungs and they can breathe better. That's why Michael Jordan used to always run backwards down the court. And his tongue always hung out to the side because he's activating the occipital nerve when he does that. When you start to study neurology, it's very cool what you see. It's very cool, right? There's now strong evidence that gut microorganisms activate the vagus nerve and that such activation plays a critical role in mediating effects on the brain and subsequently behavior. The gut microorganisms have a critical role in brain function. Critical. This paper went up on the scene. I saw this paper one night at 10 o'clock at night, and I called my friend, Dr. Vojdani, and he said, Tom, it's 10 o'clock. Are you okay? Yes, Ari, I'm fine. But listen to this. And I read him the title of the paper. Increased intestinal permeability correlates with sigmoid mucosa alpha-synuclein staining and endotoxin exposure markers in early Parkinson's disease. And he said, what? Just like me when I said, have you ever heard of early Parkinson's? There's no such thing as early Parkinson's. Parkinson's is when you, and then you get the diagnosis, post-symptoms. But they're talking about early Parkinson's and intestinal permeability. What? This was the first paper I saw on this topic. It's now well established that the pathological hallmark of Parkinson's are neuronal inclusions called Lewy bodies, or Lewy neurites, whose main component is alpha-synuclein. So alpha-synuclein is the protein that makes up these Lewy bodies. That's the important thing to know here. Well, it's not important, but I'm going to refer to alpha-synuclein. It's believed these alpha-synuclein aggregates are the first step resulting in neuronal loss responsible for the neurological symptoms and signs of Parkinson's. Okay, so these misfolded proteins, they get all kind of twisted up and locked in that twisted position. They're the first step in what eventually becomes Parkinson's. Okay, that's interesting. The GI system and the brain are directly linked anatomically with the dorsal motor nucleus of the vagus nerve, a brain region proposed to express Lewy pathology very early in the disease process. Okay. So the vagus nerve is the nerve that goes all the way down the spine, and it goes up the spine. So the messages from the gut bacteria, the 9-to-1 ratio, is going up the vagus nerve. Okay, we know that. Okay. Gut leakiness in patients with a genetic susceptibility to Parkinson's may be a pivotal early step, promoting a pro-inflammatory oxidative environment, contributing to the initiation and or progression of Parkinson's. What? Intestinal permeability? Really? Early step promoting a pro-inflammatory oxidative environment? Really? Okay, yeah, permeability does that. Indeed, it's been suggested that the GI tract might be a portal of entry for a putative Parkinson's pathogen. That's alpha-synuclein, is a Parkinson's pathogen, triggering pathological changes in the submucosal myenteric neurons, that's just inside the shags of the shag carpeting of your intestines, which then spread through the vagus nerve up to the area of the brain called the medulla oblongata. From there, pathological changes may move rostrally, ultimately resulting in the clinically defining motor symptoms of Parkinson's when there is extensive involvement in the middle portion of the disease at the level of the midbrain substantia nigra. Okay, so that's kind of interesting. That was 2010. Let's go to 2015 and the Journal of Alzheimer's Research and look at the title of this paper. Mechanisms of Molecular Mimicry Involving the Microbiota in Neurodegeneration. Okay. This paper describes the specific molecular pathways of these cross-seeding and neuroinflammatory processes. Both Parkinson's and Alzheimer's involve the formation of transmissible, self-propagating prion-like proteins. Transmissible? From where? That's the question I had in the middle of the night one night. Bacteria proteins, may elicit cross-seeding misfolding, inflammation and oxidative stress, and cellular toxicity in the neurodegenerative conformational disorders, initiating or otherwise influencing the development of Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, and other nerve diseases. The spreading in the brain of misfolded alpha-synuclein and tau is with Alzheimer's, appears to be along neuronal connections through axonal membranes utilizing a prion, like remember prions, mad cow disease? Prions? Cell-to-cell spread with neuronal connectivity, not proximity, being critical. What are they saying? The alpha-synuclein gets produced in the gut. It goes through the intestinal wall into the enteric nerves. The enteric nerves merge into the vagus nerve, goes up the spine to the brain, and deposits in the area of the brain where there's kind of like a magnetic pull for that misfolded protein. If it's alpha-synuclein, it's in the substantia nigra, you get Parkinson's. If it's beta-amyloid tau, it's Alzheimer's, it goes to different areas of the brain, you get Alzheimer's. It starts in the gut. and it's cell by cell. It's connectivity, not proximity. So these alpha-synuclein misfolded proteins are found in the cells of the vagus nerve going up, and depending on the autopsy, when you do a person autopsy, depending, sometimes it's still down here, sometimes it's way up there, sometimes it's all the way up in the brain, and yep, those are the people that have been diagnosed with Parkinson's. But it's cell by cell, these misfolded proteins that are produced in the gut are eventually getting up to the brain. Isn't that cool to know? You think it's okay to have a little gluten once in a while when you have a sensitivity to gluten? I'll show you how it affects your gut and the bacteria in your gut. You get these cerebellar antibodies, you get myelin antibodies, you alter the gut flora. This is so very cool. Furthermore, my enteric neurons in the gut wall contain alpha-synuclein deposits in Parkinson's. These findings suggest that the origin of protein misfolding in Parkinson's may reside in the gut. There's now evidence that these central responses to intentional infection and inflammation may be modulated by the good bacteria. The central neural circuits influenced by the gut microbiota are reported to include the GABAergic, glutaminergic, serotonergic, dopaminergic, histaminergic, and adrenergic systems. The gut bacteria modulates or controls or directs the production of your brain hormones, your brain nerve neurotransmitters. It's the gut bacteria that controls all of this. How important is the gut bacteria? Critical. Why is there 10 times more of them than us? Because they control everything. Why is there 9 times more nerve messages going up than coming down? Because they're telling the rest of the body what to do. Isn't this cool? This is very, very cool. When you start, you go, what? Now, you aren't going to walk out here and be able to repeat all of this, right? I just want to kind of, what? What? Because then you'll take the time to read a little on your own. You'll get all these studies, and maybe you'll order one of the studies, or there are 17 of them are free. So you just download the ones that are free and you just start reading. And you know, sometimes I've got to read these studies 2 and 3 and 4 times to understand what they're saying. I'm kind of semi-geek, you know? I'm not full geek. Similar, a number of studies have demonstrated that gut bacteria influence brain-derived neurotrophic factor levels, particularly in the hippocampus. That's the hormone that stimulates new nerve growth. Brain-derived neurotrophic factor. The gut bacteria controls that. If anybody is tired, please stand up and go in the back of the room and slap yourself. If people close their eyes in my lecture, I don't think I'm boring, right? And it's a little bit of overwhelm. I know it's overwhelm. I know it is. And our brains just can't take that much usually. So if you find yourself nodding off, it's okay to stand up. And maybe we all should stand up for a minute. Yeah, Dr. Rita's doing her thing. So everybody can stand up for a minute and let's do the Dr. Rita, right? Kind of shake it a little bit. How fast can you shake? How fast can you shake? Shake, 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 shake. That's pretty good. Nice. That's, yeah. All right, good. Thanks. Thanks. Sit down. Thank you. Thank you so much. Well, I've never done that before. Thank you. Good. All right, here we go. We're at the very early stages of understanding the complex communication system between gut bacteria and the brain. However, there is already strong supporting evidence for what was only a few years ago a largely hypothetical relationship between the gut microbiota, mood, and behavior. So let me ask you, does your doctor have time to read the new research coming out? No, they don't have any time. So are they familiar with this? Most likely not. So if you try to talk to them in your kind of not quite layman, but not geek language about this, you're gonna run into trouble, right? So you take a study with you when you go in to talk to your doctor. You say, you know, I read this, and if I'm understanding this correctly, this is what it means. Could you check this out and let me know if I'm reading it correctly, right? Premise number 6, a gluten-free diet may contribute to dysbiosis. Diet influences the composition of the gut microbiota and host health, particularly in patients suffering from food-related diseases. In the present preliminary study, the effects of a gluten-free diet on the composition and immune function of the gut microbiota were analyzed in 10 healthy subjects. These are not celiacs, these are healthy subjects. Bifidobacterium, Clostridium, and Fecalbacterium decrease as a result of the gluten-free diet. Bifidobacterium, Lactobacillus, and Bifidobacterium longum counts decreased, while Enterobacter and E. coli counts increased after the gluten-free diet. Tumor necrosis factor alpha, interferon gamma, IL-10, IL-8 production was also reduced. Those are all anti-inflammatories. It was reduced after the gluten-free diet. You alter your microbiota in a bad way when you go on a gluten-free diet. It's like, wake up, everyone. Wake up. Yeah, you alter the microbiota in a detrimental way when you put people on a gluten-free diet. The gluten-free diet led to reductions in beneficial gut bacteria populations and the ability of fecal samples to stimulate the host immunity. Thus, the gluten-free diet may constitute an environmental variable to be considered in treated celiac patients for its possible effects on gut health. Anyone know why that happens? Okay, good. One of the components of wheat is called FODMAPs. FODMAPs are fermentable carbohydrates, right? So we average 132.5 pounds of wheat consumption per person per year in our country. Now, I don't eat any, so that means somebody else is eating 265 pounds, right? And you think of all the people that are gluten-free or, like in this room, sometimes gluten-free. I'm going to jab you every chance I get because you need to understand the consequences of what you're doing. I want you bright and sparkly when you're in your 60s and 70s. Not like kind of guarded, walking down the stairs, right? Oh, yeah, my brain's not working like it used to. I'm getting old. How old are you? Well, I'm 37. Right? I mean, we laugh, but that's true for many, isn't it? Isn't it? So you need to understand this. Why? Okay. So, people that eat toast for breakfast, bagels for lunch, or toaster bagels for breakfast, sandwich for lunch, pasta for dinner, croutons on their salads, cookies and all that, their bodies become dependent on the FODMAPs as their primary source of prebiotic. You pull that out of the diet, and then your beneficial bacteria that was counting on that prebiotic, and so now you do gluten-free stuff, and that's just paste. Oh, blueberry muffins are gluten-free. I can have one. It's healthy for me. No, it's not. It's garbage. It's just not as bad a garbage and poisonous as the gluten-containing ones, right? So your body becomes dependent on the FODMAPs, and you reduce your FODMAP content. That's why I tell every patient, Mrs. Patient, every day you take at least a forkful of fermented vegetables, every day, and just switch them out. One day it's sauerkraut, one day it's kimchi, one day it's miso, and you just switch them out. Whole Foods has 10 different types of non-pasteurized fermented vegetables. There's a curry flavor, a cumin flavor, there's a bunch of different flavors. And just put them all in the refrigerator and just take one every day for you and your family. And every adult eats a pound of vegetables a day, 5 different colors, a pound a day. Sometimes when we're on the road traveling, as we were talking at lunch, we don't get a chance to eat enough vegetables. You have to play catch up. That's why this lunch today was so great. You know, it's just fabulous. But that's the danger of a gluten-free diet. That's one of the dangers of a gluten-free diet, is that you reduce their FODMAP content, and the result is they lose their beneficial bacteria, and the bad guys that are being kept in check a little bit because maybe your lactobacilli count's high enough to keep the E. coli down, but now the lactobacilli go down because you're not feeding anymore, and the E. coli goes, oh, great, and the comes up like this, and now you have more pathogenic bacterial dominance. Case study number 3. Here's a 32-year-old man with a 1-year history of balance difficulties, presented 1-week history of getting worse, including hand tremors and gait disturbances. Admission review of symptoms revealed a 60-pound weight loss during the past year, which he attributed to diarrhea consisting of 3 to 4 loose bowel movements a day. Whoa! What's wrong with the gut? What's wrong with the gut? I don't care that he's in a wheelchair at the moment. What's wrong with the gut? He's lost 60 pounds in a year because of diarrhea. What's wrong with the gut? Don't get lost by the symptoms. Laboratory studies revealed a slightly elevated phosphorus, but everything else was normal. Brain MR imaging showed increased signal intensity. Here's where the lesions are in the brain. You can see where the arrows are pointing. 32-year-old guy in a wheelchair now. This is not good. This is not good. Initial diagnostic considerations included ALS and Friedreich's ataxia. Because of the ataxia, they did a workup looking for gluten ataxia, and sure enough, the guy was a celiac. So they put him on a gluten-free diet with improvement of his symptoms during the next several months. Repeat brain MRI imaging revealed complete resolution of the lesions. You reverse the lesions in the brain on a gluten-free diet sometimes. He's out of the wheelchair, symptoms are all gone, his lesions are gone in 2 years. In my all-day presentation, I've got 5 studies, MRIs reversing lesions in the brain on a gluten-free diet. His symptoms, MR imaging lesions improved and resolved respectively on appropriate treatment of celiac. And the summary in this article in the American Journal of Neuroradiology, because ALS is a progressive and untreatable disease, while celiac is easily treatable, considering the latter as a cause of neurologic disorders in patients with ALS-like symptoms may be indicated. You just might want to check. So if somebody in your family or in your practice says, you know, diagnosed with ALS, oh, I'm so sorry to hear that, please follow your radiologist or your neurologist's advice, but let's check them. Check them for what? Check them for a food sensitivity, because sometimes, I was in the seminar, I saw the studies, sometimes food can trigger all this and you get the food out of there and the person gets better. Sometimes, it's just worth checking. So I've shown you a 3.5-year-old girl with a tumor in her eye diagnosed as Kaposi sarcoma, a 14-year-old girl with gluten psychosis that they had admitted her to the psychiatric ward twice and they put her on steroids, and now ALS in a 32-year-old guy. What condition would you not check? Just check, because wherever the weak link in the chain is, that's where it's going to manifest, if you have the sensitivity. We must be aware that addressing the microbiome is now becoming a foundational principle in addressing chronic disease. This is a primary contributor to the continued intestinal, then systemic inflammation, increasing morbidity and mortality. Last premise, every office benefits from offering successful, notice that's capitalized, successful, comprehensive, thorough guidance for patients to transition into a microbiome-balancing dietary lifestyle via a well-trained nutritionist, registered dietitian, or staff specialist. Doctors don't have time to talk about this with their patients. Every office, and every lecture now I put this in here, every office needs to have a nutritionist, a registered dietitian, a health coach, train one of the staff properly to take these people and hold their hand. You can't give them a handout and say, here, eat like this. You can't do that when you're changing their primary way of selecting foods. You've got to work with them on that. You got to take care of them. You got to walk with them, right? Many individuals were not content with the services provided by their healthcare team to help them manage celiac. The complex manufacture of modern processed food means the ongoing advice of a trained dietitian or nutritionist is required. Close follow-up to assess for correction of nutrient deficiencies is advised. A medical team willing to inform adequately and reassure patients, a strict follow-up. This is from Mayo, this one. A strict follow-up in the early phases after diagnosis, and last but not least, contact with other patients and patient associations are indispensable features. Remember, celiac diagnosis in childhood is associated with a 40% increased risk in suicide because other kids in school treat them so poorly and they're depressed and they don't want to go to school. They don't want to go out. Now, the gig has summer camps, the gluten intolerance group. They have 2 summer camps a year, and my next summit will be out next year. And a large portion of the proceeds are going to go to finance a couple more summer camps. Now, here's what they do in the summer camps. They have 2 kitchens, 1 dining area, but 2 separate kitchens. There's the camp cook who's making the pizza and the pasta and all that stuff. And then Gig takes over the other kitchen and they bring in a chef. They do a chef. Chef volunteers for a week. Make the best pizza, the best macaroni and cheese. And so within 2 days of these kids eating this stuff and how it smells, the kids eating the regular food, they start wanting the gluten-free food. And within 4 or 5 days, everybody wants the gluten-free food. And then so they sit, and these kids are with celiac are finally able to see that they're not the weird ones, that they're the weird ones eating the crap food, right? Excuse me, but they, and then Gig has some classes where they talk with the kids. What's it like in school? They say, oh, they're so mean. I said, they really are. You see, it's just because they didn't know, because as soon as these guys know, then you guys are friends, right? You enjoy the food together. Yeah. So we just have to help educate these people. So they're training young people how to be ambassadors in schools. Yes. Yeah, isn't that great? That's really great. Follow-up visits with the dietitian are essential to assess knowledge, competence, and compliance, as well as provide reinforcement. If possible, a return visit should be scheduled within 1 to 3 months. And these are the things you talk about on the return. And this paper, I know, is free to download, so it'll be in your list, so you've got this. As with any chronic condition, support groups are an invaluable resource. Every major city has celiac support groups now. Just Google your city and say celiac support group. That's all you have to do. Okay, what have we done? I've given you 3 case reports. A conjunctival tumor diagnoses Kaposi sarcoma, gluten psychosis in a 14-year-old, and amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. All very different, but all very similar, right? Who would have thought reversing a tumor in the eye within 2 months just by getting gluten out of the diet, right? There's nothing that may not be helped if the person has a sensitivity to gluten. 7 premises to look at. Food sensitivities may have a lasting, significant impact on central nervous system function. Gluten sensitivity is not yet recognized by practitioners as a primary presentation in their office. Gluten sensitivity, with or without the enteropathy celiac disease, is a systemic autoimmune disease, wherever the weak link in your chain is. Food selection has a direct impact on dysbiosis and may be an initiating factor in an autoimmune cascade. Both Parkinson's and Alzheimer's involve the formation of transmissible, self-propagating prion-like proteins. A gluten-free diet may contribute to dysbiosis. Every office benefits from offering successful, comprehensive, thorough guidance for patients to transition into a microbiome-balancing dietary lifestyle via a well-trained nutritionist, registered dietitian, or staff specialist. In this presentation, I've shown you cross-reactivity with Purkinje cells. Antigliadin antibodies react with blood vessels in the brain. 1 exposure of gluten per month increases your risk of dying early, 6 to 1. Diet changes explain 57% of the total structural variation in gut microbiota, genetics only 12%. Gluten-free diet may lead to reductions in beneficial gut bacteria. Gut microbiota influence GABAergic, glutaminergic, serotonergic, dopaminergic, histaminergic, and adrenergic systems. That's brain function across the board from your gut. All 29 studies are available to you for free at thedr.com/shine. You can just go there, and 15 of the 29 studies are the full articles. thedr.com/shine. And they're there for you. They're all there for you. And I hope that every speaker from now on, I say this now, every speaker from now on will make that available in every lecture, because I had to go through all the hard work to get the papers. It takes a lot of time to do that. Why should I make you have to do all that hard work if I want you to understand this information, right? So I hope I'm starting a new pattern here that everyone will do. Yeah. Make sure you take care of yourself this weekend, yes? Make sure to tell those important to you how much you love them. And with that, I'd say thank you very much for your kind attention. Thank you.
Some wand action.
Awesome.
Thank you.
Yes.
Was that awesome or what? Woohoo! Who learned something? Who plans on having gluten every once in a while if you know you're sensitive? You're going to continue, huh? You take a little more convincing. You're good with that. Thank you. Good. So would you like to draw one of our drawings?
Sure.
All right. So we're going to start drawing for the prizes. So just stick your hand in and pull it out.
Okay.
I'll read it and see who wins.
Yeah, the first one is Tom O'Brien.
Oh!
No, actually, I'm really happy. This is Jason. Where's Jason? No, Jason J. Oh, you're Jason J.? Okay, great. Jason J.
Okay, you get this. Oh, this is amazing. This is a cherry juice concentrate. Doesn't raise blood sugar. And there's a recipe on my blog for you making chocolate bonbons with it. Gluten-free, of course. Low glycemic. All right. Thank you, Tom.
Oh, wait. Someone show up late. I'm going to put them in.
Oh, so many. Okay. Cool. Okay. Let's see who's next.
tell you guys to write.
CGP 330799. Who's got 330799? Where'd you put these? I'm going to take these ones. 330799. It looks like Wanda, Warda, Marta. 799. Going once? You get those, and you get the video. It's Indulge Without the Bulge. That's a video that I made a few years back with a friend of mine. We put it together, and it's like how to get through the holidays without this. Yummy recipes and tips.
Perfect timing.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm going to put this one up here. Right? Okay. Lynn. Lynn? 734 is the last three digits. All right, Lynn. How do you say your name? How do you say your last name? Kulik. Okay, great. So this is a shirt that was donated by Diane Letchworth. Is that adorable or what? Diane, raise your hand, stand up.
Fairy cat mother.
Yes. You got to check out her blog, too. It's, what is it, D Squared Wellness. She writes the best blogs. She's as funny as can be. Oh, the pens. Good. All right. You got it.
Thank you.
Oh, good. Awesome. Awesome. Okay. What else do we have? All right. Sherry Callison. Burtonville. Where is Burtonville, Texas? 779. Right outside of Dallas. All right. So what you're getting is Mighty Maca. Who knows about Mighty Maca? Woohoo! Dr. Anna Kabeka, she's a good friend of mine. She developed this, and it's amazing. It's a combination of maca with all kinds of greens. And I take this with me on every trip, and I put it in my like jar and water and shake it up when I can't make a green smoothie. Awesome. Okay. All right, so Allie is going to come on up and tell us about our next fun activity that we have after a little break. We can go to the bathroom and all that. But we have a fun activity planned, and Allie put it together. And this is, did we take her thing? Jessica Dingler. We shouldn't have taken both of these. I should have left them for one, right? Because we're going to.
Yeah, we're just watching.
Yeah, okay. Vitamineral Rush. I love this stuff. It's a combination of. It's all whole foods, it's raw, it's liquid, and liquid nutrients are going to be absorbed best. And you just put a squirt in some water at the beginning of the day, and it's got all kinds of great stuff in it. And this was from one of our sponsors, Sun Warrior. The mineral one? Yeah, the mineral one is more high. This has some minerals in it, but a lot of vitamins. And the mineral one has a lot more minerals and has fulvic acid. I think this might have fulvic acid. And they all have methylcobalamin and folate. We'll talk about that later. You should always be doing, if you're going to do B12, it should be methyl or adenosyl or hydroxy, not cyano. And if you're doing a supplement with folic acid, always call the company and find out what form it's in. Sometimes it is a natural folate, but most of the time it's not. And folic acid we'll talk about it later when we talk about, or tomorrow when we talk about blood-brain barrier. So thank you.
What's funny is I was actually going to buy this.
Good job. Okay, perfect. You'll take those. And we're going to introduce Allie Smith. Allie is one of our practitioners in the NEPT program, and she's been like amazing organizing us through this whole process of getting this conference together. And she came up with this amazing activity, and it's going to be fun, and it's for team building and problem solving. And it also ties in building a healthy body. So she'll tell you about it.
Yeah. So as Dr. Edie Marie said, I'm one of her students in her NEPT program, and I absolutely love it. And part of what I really love about it is the support not only from Dr. Rita Marie, but also from all the other practitioners and students in the program as well. So one thing I thought would be great to create here is just an opportunity for some goofiness, some movement, for us to, you know, get out of our chair, be moving a little bit, and most importantly, getting to know one another. Because I think it is so important to realize that on this journey, working with your clients and your patients, that you're not alone. And there is so much information, and no single person, I mean, Tom O'Brien himself said he doesn't know it all. He looks up stuff, right? So having the support of one another is critical. So this is just for fun, and we're gonna get to know one another and get support from one another. What we'll do is we'll divide into teams. There will be 10 total teams, and you'll each get a packet. What we're gonna do is different activities. In your packet, you'll see on the second page that there is a list of activities to complete that are not in a designated area. So what that means is that with your group, you can complete them to earn points in this room, in the hallway, anywhere that you want. I mean, if you want to go outside in a puddle, by all means, no limits, get creative and enjoy yourselves. Then on the third page, it's where it starts a total of 10 activities, and that is in a designated area. If you'll go down the hallway where we had the food buffet, go to the very end of the hallway, the very last room on the right, is the Robertson Leftwich room, which, by the way, is the same room that we're doing Qigong in the mornings. So if you didn't join this morning, make sure that you come out tomorrow morning at 6:45. So these activities will be in that room. You'll look along the wall, and you'll see different signs that have numbers labeled with the activity. Most of them aren't led, so you'll just have to read the directions carefully and decide with your team which ones you're gonna complete. We won't have enough time to do all of them, so choose wisely. Don't spend too much time on an activity. It's okay to let some go if you decide it's not a good fit for your team. So that being said, what we'll do is we'll meet back in this room at, I believe, at 4:30. What time is it now? Yes, so you need to be here at 4:30, no later than, because there's a part two of the activity. So once you do your team building activities, we'll come back in here and then have some discussion as a group, and we'll explain part two. So right now we're doing part one. It lasts till 4:30, then we'll meet in here. The objective is to earn as many points as possible, and all the points are numbered on the activities. So to start out, we're gonna count off. We'll start here. We're gonna count off by tens. So you'll be one. Okay, so the ones are gonna meet under the exit sign here. The twos are going to meet just in front of the raffle table. The threes here in front of that door. The fours here by the sign, the easel, thank you. The fives here by the pumpkin in front of the stage. The sixes over by that mic, or speaker, anyway. The sevens in front of the screen. The eights under that exit sign. The nines in front of the cups. And the tens under that light. For those of you who counted off for me first, let me give you your packet to take to your team. We'll see you back here at 4:30.